This week on TWIP, we're diving into the mind of a traveling storyteller with photographer Matt Jacob. From India to Mongolia, Matt has traveled the globe with his trusty medium format camera, documenting hidden worlds, always with profound respect and artistry. So get ready for a riveting conversation with traveling portrait photographer Matt Jacob.
This is TWIP.
Let's dive into this. First of all, Matt Jacob, welcome to the podcast, man. It's been, you and I have been chatting back and forth in one way or another for what, a couple months now, trying to get this thing scheduled. We are here now. How the heck are you doing, sir?
Yeah, I'm good. It's bright and early where I am, so I'm raring to go. Thanks for having me.
No, thank you for coming on. And for the folks that are watching this, a special thanks to Matt. He got up at 6 a.m. for this. 6 a.m. to be on a podcast. I think I'm just entering REM sleep at 6 a.m. So I don't know how people do that. But welcome, and I appreciate you for getting up early and doing this. I think it'll be a great discussion. So let's dive into the conversation. Let's do some background first of all. Yeah, I usually start this off with like, what's your origin story or your Spider-Man radioactive spider story, right? And I feel like looking at your bio and kind of researching you a little bit before this interview, lots of tangents. There are lots of things that happened that drove you to where you are today. How do you describe yourself when you're stuck in an elevator with someone and you're like, hey, what do you do? Or at a cocktail party or something. What's your go-to line for those folks?
Yeah, I'm still working on it. 41 years old, still working on that. I think it's difficult to kind of distill it down to kind of one elevator pitch, but I grew up in the UK. I dreamt of being a pilot when I was a young boy and chased that dream. I always had like a little entrepreneurial kind of rebel, independent itch that I wanted to scratch from a young age. And that kind of carried along with me for my 20s and into my 30s. As I was a pilot, very privileged, and then I got to travel the world free and see some fantastic places and realize, oh my goodness, there's a lot out here that I don't know about. I'm ignorant. I need to see a lot more of this. I need to learn about the different cultures, different societies, and like the more I traveled, the more curious and I became, and that kind of independence and individual kind of necessity to go and do something for myself was growing stronger through my 30s. And I can't even remember how I picked up a camera. I mean, I'm a gadget guy. I'm a boy who loves his toys. And one reason I got into flying, and you know, the camera in my 20s was just another kind of gadget that I could play around with. As the digital cameras kind of evolved, I just became more interested in the technology side of it. And then as I was traveling, I realized, my goodness, I can actually capture some cool things on this piece of equipment. And that was kind of it. I experimented a lot with different genres, depending on where I was. And, you know, I'd buy the biggest lens I could without even knowing anything about photography at all. And it wasn't until I decided to take it a little bit more seriously, you know, a bit of kind of validation from friends and family. Oh, you know, you might have something here, like you've got some good shots. I went on a workshop. This is back in 2017. And that was my kind of seminal moment. It was, you know, to be around a couple of professionals who just knew so much, or I felt at the time knew so much. And they literally, it was at one 10-minute lesson, practical kind of, you know, in a room with this professional, just talking about light, showing me light and how we can pose a subject to make it look like a professional image, right? And that was my light bulb moment. That was it. I was done. This was incredible. It was both simple and complex and beautiful at the same time. And yeah, I didn't look back. So, I continued to travel, and there was something that sparked my interest with other cultures and, you know, ethnic groups and different kind of lesser known cultures around the world that I wanted to kind of find out about, but also try and document in an artistic way if I could. And that kind of, leads me to here and just continue to work on my craft and hopefully do something that's of meaning to both myself and my audience.
And I want to dive into that. Before we get there, though, I want to talk a little bit about just the learning curve. So being relatively new, I mean, you're not decades into your photography journey, but being relatively, you know, kind of new to the art form, how do you find yourself? Like, what is your learning style? Do you find yourself, okay, let me go watch a bunch of YouTube videos or read a bunch of books or take workshops and then get inspired, then go shoot? Or are you, because you have the gift of being able to travel to these exotic, let's call them exotic locations, do you, okay, I'm going to put myself in this situation and capture it and then sort of learn as I go? What's the best modality for you to learn in, do you think?
Yeah, I think before I answer that, I think it's important to note that I am, you know, still completely green in this industry, and that's why it's a privilege to be on your show. I'm learning all the time, and I want to put myself in situations where I can be challenged, and that's really my main modality is just practice. I talk about this with some of my students all the time. Like, you just can't substitute for practice. You can watch a million YouTube videos, you can watch, which are great, but like, I'm not diminishing that as a learning tool at all.
Sure.
Same with workshops, same with online courses, same with everything. But until you actually get out there and make mistakes and realize, learn from those mistakes, and the same with everything in life, I guess, but, you know, really put yourself in challenging situations deliberately and mindfully and intentionally. Okay, I'm going to see how this goes, or I'm going to try and shoot this type of thing. And it may, you know, most of the time it does go wrong, or you have to have a backup plan. So, you know, that's my, I get out there as much as I can, but I'm kind of a project-based photographer. So I'll do 3 to 4 big projects a year, depending on which country. It may be here at home, but it may be abroad. And I will put everything into that, and I will put myself under pressure to, in a good way, like good stress, to put myself in a position where, okay, this project needs to be better than the last one. You know, you're only as good as your last piece of work. So I just want to keep moving, keep evolving. The way I have known how to do that, considering my evolution as a photographer over the last 5 years, is just by doing. And, you know, I have a little bit of a rebel streak. There's a reason I want to quit my job, because I don't want to have a boss. I don't want to be told what to do. So, you know, if I have, it's very, like, I have a lot of professional photographer friends, and it's great because we're on a level playing field and we can collaborate. But if there's someone who thinks they know more about me, more than me, I will immediately react to that. And it completely is something I'm working on mental health wise. But, you know, that's just the way. I'd rather go and figure this out for myself, and it may take longer, but I know the voice and the style I want to portray in my work. I know the stories I want to tell, and it's a matter of me figuring that out and being as kind of critical of myself as possible while doing it.
Yeah, I'm the same way. You know, just learning things by doing, right? And kind of diving into it. You can, what was it? Who was it that said that? I think it was Mike Tyson said, "Hey, everyone's got a plan until you get punched in the face," right? So you could plan all day long, especially for the trips that you're doing. Okay, I'm going to do this. I'm going to make sure I get this shot. I've run photographer's ephemeris. I'm going to get this sunset at this time. Until you get there and the chaos of life happens, you don't know what's what, right? So you have to actually walk through those paces in order to feel it. Do you feel like you've and I feel like I know the answer to this, I'm going to ask it anyway, it's a contrived question, but when you go on these adventures, do you feel like each one gives you a little nugget of something that you didn't know before you went on that adventure? And if so, what's one of the nuggets that you've taken away from one of your trips?
A million nuggets. You know, every day presents something. A lot of it's people management, actually. A lot of, you know, people think photographers is, you know, point and shoot, right? And we know the people who do it, we know that's, you know, 1% of it is the actual pressing the shutter button and figuring out technicalities. Certainly in my style where, you know, I just did a trip to Varanasi, India, and I had a student with me who was booking the trip and he wanted me to go with him and kind of just be next to him and talk to him about, you know, the way I light things, the way I want to tell a story, the way I pose subjects, if it's, if there's posing involved, or the way I set up a scene, if we need to set up a scene, or the way we shoot on the fly, or whatever it might be, in order to create a you know, a valuable series. So this was an interesting one because I hadn't done like a one-on-one kind of client student type trip abroad before, and not least in Varanasi, India, which is just, I don't know if you've been, but it is crazy. It's India is a wonderful and diverse and dynamic country. Varanasi is like the next level. It's just insane. And he had booked this trip 4 days and five nights to kind of tell a story of the sadhus there, the very holy men, religious people who live, you know, a very pure and holy life. Anyway, this, I was just immediately, I knew 4 days is probably enough just to do a recce and to get to know some of the people, have a feeling of the environment, maybe set up a few kind of test shots. So I was like, immediately, this is going to be a challenge. It's 4 days in somewhere neither of us have been before. We had a fixer on the ground, which really helped. So, you know, there are a lot of lessons that came from that, and how we you know, manage expectations with what we're going to get. And so we did a lot. We had to improvise a lot. And my biggest, if you do kind of my style of photography, where it's kind of project based, it's abroad, maybe you don't know the location. You don't know the location and you need a guide, or you need someone on the ground to really kind of hold your hand, essentially. And that's that. Again, that was probably my biggest lesson from this. Excuse me. If you don't have someone who's going to help you on the ground, you know, and I'm having to deal with a student as well as an assistant, as well as the fixer, and just kind of manage the trip and really get some photos if I can. If you don't have a pivotal person on the ground who's able to go and speak to people for you, or go and wreck your location while you kind of talk technical stuff with someone or with your assistant, you think about the shot rather than going to a place and talking to someone you've never met before. So, you know, that again was one of my biggest takeaways. If you don't have, and I've worked with a lot of fixers before, and man, if you get a bad one, it ruins your whole trip. Or if you don't have, going back to my original point, that just people management, if you're not able to relate to any of the people you're with, but especially the person on the ground who's helping you and guiding you and translating for you, and, you know, if you don't have that relationship solid, then, you know, you're not going to get anything really. And if you are, it's not going to be great.
And that's why people take workshops, right? For the most part, is to have someone like you that they know, like, and trust and admire your work, organizing everything for them in a location that they want to go to. So they're working with a net and they can have a good time, versus like me dropping myself somewhere in India and having to figure everything out, not being sure if I'm in a safe area, if not, and cultural sensitivities that I don't know about, you know, all these things. So when you're on a workshop, all that stuff, if you have the proper fixer or guide, that person is making sure all that's good, so then you can go in and concentrate on the photography and the attendees. Is that close?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, this example is kind of a mini workshop, right? It's just a one-on-one thing, but it was essentially a workshop. And 100%, and that's why I always recommend workshops over everything else. If you can afford workshops these days with good photographers, can be expensive, right? But depending on, you know, you have a wide array of them. But I would always recommend, if you're starting out or you kind of know the basics, right, and you want to take your photography to the next level, well, workshops are so invaluable, because you can do exactly what you've just said. You don't have to worry about, you often you don't have to worry about, just turn up with your camera and you just you're like a sponge, right? You just absorb as much information as possible and you focus on learning how to shoot better.
All right. So before we dive into more of the sort of, you know, nerding out about photography and exotic locations and all that, in the beginning, I was sort of asking you about your motivations and your origin story and all of moving into the world of photography and travel and all that. But I know you had a health scare not too long ago. Are you okay with kind of sharing a little bit of how that went down and how it affected your outlook on photography and the world?
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, actually, it was quite a while ago. We're talking about 15 years ago now. This was I had cancer, and nothing was kind of that, I want to say serious, but obviously it was cancer, but nothing was life-threatening that came of it. I didn't have to have, you know, months and months of treatment or anything like that. It was a kind of a simple fix, and then, you know, obviously some intense monitoring and kind of some, you know, outpatient treatment. It wasn't, looking back on it, it was obviously a scare, but it definitely just reframed my way of thinking. Certainly as a young kind of mid-20s man, and it was a kind of line in the sand where, you know, the cliche life's too short really kind of came to fruition. And, you know, that was a real turning point for me in terms of chasing my dreams, saying yes to everything, opening up opportunities for myself. And, you know, really I've kind of lived my life like that ever since. And, you know, sometimes it's really hasn't helped me, but a lot of the time, you know, just seeking opportunities, trying to take life by the scruff of the neck and just go for everything, and knowing that, and this comes back to photography, because photography for me, it saved my life in many other different ways, not in a physical sense maybe, but in a creative, psychological sense. It, you know, and I hear this with so many people, it really saved me in so many ways. You know, we don't have a long enough episode to talk about that. So it's kind of like when photography came into my life, that mindset really helped me to just go, yes, I'm gonna see where this goes, and take it as far as I can. And if it doesn't go that far, then that's okay. It can be just a little side thing, or I don't enjoy it anymore, and that's cool. But being able to have the, I guess, the braveness to just say yes to a lot of things and see where your interests really, how deep those interests are, and how you can kind of create a meaningful life from those interests. That was how getting cancer really reshaped my way of thinking. And so kind of photography was a result of that a little bit further down the line.
Do you think you would have been the photographer you are today had that not happened? Because that was way back in your university days, right?
Yeah. I don't know. I think about it most days, in a good sense. You know, just grateful that I'm not in that situation, and grateful that, you know, there's poor people out there that are going through so much more. That gives me empathy. And I'm not sure if I would have that empathy if I hadn't kind of had that wake up call. I don't know. We're playing what ifs, I guess. But
yeah.
I think having empathy as a photographer, especially as a portrait photographer, is probably the number one skill you can learn. And it is a skill. It's not something, you know, some people do have a kind of good empathy skills naturally, but you really can learn it. You really can craft it. And with empathy, you can take photography, especially portrait photography, to wonderful levels, in my opinion. Yeah.
That's perfect. That's the perfect segue for the next thing I want to ask you. And that is, how do you insert yourself? What's your MO for inserting yourself into these different cultures with your camera, this foreigner coming in with all this expensive gear and, you know, and unknown intentions? How do you get in there and win You know, build, use your empathy and build the trust and come away with these outstanding images. And we'll show some of them and put them in the blog posts as well. But how do you do that? And how do you like put yourself in the mindset that you're not feeling like you're an intruder on this culture and you're going to, you know, leave with the riches of the images and, you know, I don't know if you're going to leave something there or not. Like, how do you manage that? You know, both internally and then external expectations to the people that you're photographing.
Such a good question. A lot of it comes with practice and just being in these environments. And again, workshops are great for this because they teach you how to, or they should teach you how to put yourselves in these situations. And, you know, I remember one of the first kind of mentors I had, or, you know, people, professionals that taught me a few lessons. When you go to a place, don't pick up a camera for like 2 days, right? If you're going to a specific place to meet specific people and tell a specific story, and I'm not saying on a workshop here, I'm saying, you know, you're on your own or you're with a friend or you're doing a project or you're just going somewhere and you've given yourself a week and I want to photograph some people, right? And I've already, you know, arranged kind of an area or a village or a town or, you know, a cohort of the population with a fixer and just enjoy the experience. Like the patience you need to get intimate exposed shots, exposed as in, figuratively exposed shots. Mm-hmm. Is underrated. The amount of patience you need to not, you know, you know what it's like. You go to someone, like, oh my goodness, what a great face, or what a great street scene, or what a great landscape. I just want to get my camera out and take shots. With people, you just can't do that. Well, you can, but you're going to alienate them immediately. Put yourself in their position, especially with lesser known kind of cultures, maybe third world populations. You know, they might know what a smartphone is, but they're definitely, they're definitely not used to having a camera thrown in their face and to be posing for a portrait, right? So, you know, just especially in their own home, right? You can't go into someone's home and just go, we're going to take some photos. People do, unfortunately, but they never resonate in terms of decent photos. So to answer your question, plan that time. Plan that those few days to not only get yourself situated. You might be jet lagged. You may not know this place. You just want to get to know and kind of bed in a little bit and break the ice. But it's exactly the same for them and the people that you're shooting. So, you know, in my case, if I was to take a recent project, then maybe take the India one because we talked about that earlier. I didn't know really what I was getting myself into. It was kind of I think I had 2-3 weeks notice, kind of jump on a plane and go. Yeah. I obviously knew about Varanasi, knew about the people there, knew about the stories of these holy men, but didn't know, you know, never met these people in my life, right? And now we're thrust into the situation. It's like, you've got a beautiful, you know, you're up at sunset because you want to recce maybe the light, or maybe you think, oh, I could get some cool shots. The willpower to just sit on your hands, let these people talk to you and let these people see you, monitor you. You know, they'll be looking at your equipment. They'll be looking at, you know, what, you know, I've got tattoos. So people, you know, talk about, and you just start to like, just get to know each other on just a basic human level. Doesn't matter about cultures. Doesn't matter about skin color. Doesn't matter about background. Doesn't matter about age, gender, whatever. That's like the true beauty of this. You're suddenly like, forced into a situation with a stranger. I mean, we are forced because we're going there going, oh, I want to take some photos, right? Yeah. You're forced into the situation with a stranger and now you're having to try and connect with them. That is not through getting your camera out and saying, can I take a photo? Eventually, if you've planned the time accordingly, you do. But it's all about trying to get to know. I mean, you're never going to get to know them fully unless you spend months with them, right? Which some people do, but give yourself some time and allow these people to get to know you at least on a surface level, so that when you eventually say, look, I'd be honored if I can take your photo, would that be okay? This is what I'm thinking. They will most likely say it would be my honor. kind of thing. And then you've got this connection which allows you to not only stay with them for longer, work with them for longer, try different things, but also it will always get just that extra 2% between good and great on your portrait.
Yeah, and it sounds like you're not the, you know, that stereotypical photographer or stereotypical street photographer who's out there with a long lens in a strange land, hiding behind a bush, getting the shots. And you're established, like you said, you're establishing a rapport and a relationship with people, and then respectfully asking for permission to make the image. I think that's why we see the images that we see, right? The other question while you were talking, I was thinking, yeah, that's great, but what about safety? You're going there, like you said, in some cases, impoverished areas where your camera bag could represent a really nice life change for someone if they had that, you know, the money associated with that camera bag. How do you manage that? Is that the fixer that's making sure and saying, hey, in this area, we're going to need security, or this area is fine, we're good to go? Like, how do you get to the point where it's okay to approach people and ask those permission questions and not have to be looking over your shoulder if someone's going to conk you in the head and take all your gear away?
I've had a few near misses. I haven't had anything serious. I've never had anything stolen. So I've been very fortunate in that respect. But a lot of this comes down to research as well. So
yeah.
Definitely the fixer. I wouldn't go anywhere that would be relatively unsafe. I mean, everywhere has a level of safety attached to it, but you know what I mean? Like the,
yeah.
That these types of places that would change their lives if they took my camera and lighting and all the equipment. I mean, I travel with quite a lot of equipment because I usually take some lighting stuff with me. So yeah, I mean, most of it comes down to the fixer. There have been numerous scenarios where I have thought, look, if he wasn't here, then I'd be in trouble. That's why, like, having a good fixer, making sure you have a relationship with him, because if you don't have a good relationship with him or her, then, you know, they may be in on it, right? You know, they may throw you under the bus as well. But yeah, so that and research, like knowing the areas. Yeah, I'm not going to put, unless someone pays me a lot of money to go into a place that has, you know, a real risk to it, but the story is worth it, then I'm probably not going to go. You know, there are so many stories that I can tell with my camera that aren't in, you know, explicitly dangerous places. But so I'll research that. You know, if I have an area that I want to go to, you know, safety will be part of my research bullet points, and you know, and then I just make a judgment call. It's how much equipment do I really need to take, for example.
Yeah.
So yeah, all of those kind of jumbled in.
And so equipment, so that there's multiple camps when it comes to equipment, right? There's some people that say, hey, I'm bringing my fixed lens Fuji with me, and that's it. Like a friend of mine, Valerie Jardin, is that type of person that she's like, I don't need anything else. I just need this one little bit of camera, no lighting, and I can, granted, the Fuji's a pretty amazing camera, but using just that camera, she can, you know, make magic. And other photographers will say, yeah, well, I need at least the holy trinity of lenses and, you know, a couple of lights or whatever, and then there's people in between. Where do you fall in that? Like, what's the process that you use when you're, you know, sitting at home in the living room looking at all the gear and preparing to get on that flight tomorrow? What's the decision process you go through that would determine if a piece of gear makes it in the bag or not?
Well, when it comes to my portraits, it's one camera, one lens, one light. It's nothing more
nice.
Than that.
Love it.
Because I with the whole lens thing, I think the more lenses you have, I think you're trying to cover, personally, I think you're trying to cover up some weakness in your photography or some kind of lack of cohesion in what you're trying to say. You know, and it's very simple to think about. If you want a good body of work that's cohesive, which I think is, again, a not enough talked about topic, then, you know, surely you got to stick with the same camera as much as you can. I mean, camera's not as important, but definitely the same lens. You know, you kind of want the same focal range throughout your images. But that being said, I do often take wide angle lens in case I run into some nice landscapes. and I want a piece. So I think about my projects in terms of series, right? So I would generally go from, you know, much like opening movie scene, you come from a wide angle, you know, scenic kind of environmental aspect into kind of that medium range focal length, and then you might get some real close-ups. So I kind of think about, and all I'm doing with those last two is just moving. I'm not changing lenses. I'm just getting closer. But with the first one, I would, depending on where I go, if a drone is allowed, I'll take a drone because I love to get some contextual shots of where I am. Often my portraits are environmental portraits, so they'll show, I'll try and put them in a really nice scene or in their own scene or in their own home or in their own work environment. And so often that is, I'll choose deliberately like some beautiful places. So I'll also want to capture that as contextual images on a landscape basis. So that'll either be a drone or like a 28 mil lens with my Canon R5.
Yeah,
that's it. But a lot of the time I just don't take that. I'm a 50 mil nifty 50 guy all day long. Like I, with the 35 mil, sometimes if I'm doing non-project, just like street stuff or lifestyle stuff at home with my wife or my dogs or people in the studio or something like that. But like serious photography projects, I'll take my medium format, 50 mil full frame equivalent, which is like 80 mil on medium format, and and a softbox and a light Profoto B1, you know, B10 Plus, and a softbox. That's it. But that does kind of, you know, just the light annoys me. But, and I don't use it every shot. I'll use it if I just need a little bit of supplemental lighting. There's a little pop to, you know, often I like to shoot with the light completely behind. Like I sometimes get silhouettes, but I love to just have a little pop kind of at an angle on the front. And that the light has saved me sometimes where the natural light has been disastrous, or, you know, we have a period of time. This was a great case in Varanasi where we have 4 days. It's 8 opportunities to shoot, right? Sunrise and sunset. But if you have a light and you have a bit of improvisation skills indoors, you can take everything for the day into an enclosed environment and do some close-up portraits with a light. So, and you can be so versatile with it. So yeah, kind of that's my setup. It allows me to just get pretty much everything. But I'm a big believer in prime lenses, huge believer in prime lenses. I never want to be that guy that's too far away. I want to be in their face. If anything, I want to be thinking, crikey, I need to back up a bit here. So, you know, that for me is the true essence of kind of the intimate portraits. It's not having a 100, 200 mil lens and hiding behind a corner, right?
Yeah, and that's what I was thinking. I was like, so I'm guessing that 70 to 200, so I mentioned that Holy Trinity, right? The, was it the 7 to 14, 14 to 24, 24 to 70, 70, 200, whatever. That, those zoom ranges that you find in most photographers' bags are not in your bag. You're shooting fixed focal length. And did I hear you say you're shooting medium format as well, not 35?
I spent a lot of my savings on a secondhand Hasselblad H16.
Yikes.
And it is just such a, I don't know, there's something about medium format. And I've talked to many people about medium format before who've used it. I have a medium format film as well. I that's another topic altogether. But there's something about medium format that I cannot put my finger on. Obviously, that we know the technical kind of attributes to it that will give a certain look. You know, bigger sensor size, you're going to get more tonal range, you're going to get shallower depth of field, you're going to get, you know, hopefully creamier bokeh and just have this kind of medium format look. With portraits, that is, it's just, for me, I haven't come close to a comparison with full frame. So I was hooked, unfortunately, because of the cost. You know, it took me years to be able to be in a position where I'm like, okay, this is a big investment. You know, for anyone who doesn't know, that, you know, that, there is, I mean, the H60s, the body, brand new. It's insane when you think about it. It's $35,000.
Yeah.
You know, and this is a camera that's, I think, 10 years old. You know, they haven't, the Hasselblad and Phase One, they have this medium format market kind of sewn up, right? They don't need to innovate. They don't need to evolve. It's just like, well, no one else is entering the market. And well, Fujifilm, I guess. But that's not true medium format. That's kind of like medium format. It's in between full frame and true medium format. So yeah, it's, I don't know, I love medium format. I have such a love affair with it. And the camera itself, and this is a good point to mention actually, the camera itself is so clunky, it's so heavy, it's so slow. It's, you know, we're talking digital cameras of 10, 15 years ago. So it makes me think, it's like film, it makes me just be more mindful. I have to have specific intent with it. I have to understand that things move a lot slower. You know, I'm not this spray and pray kind of guy with the 70 to 200 where I'm just going, okay, I've got 100 photos. One of them will hopefully be okay, which I love about the medium format because it just slows everything down. You just got to think a lot more about stuff.
Yeah, I love that. And then with that, I mean, you know, we were talking about safety of gear. I mean, that just your camera alone, let alone the lens and the digital back that's on there, all that's sizable to be carrying around. So, and with that, if you're shooting medium format, me shooting full frame have the luxury of bringing a second body just in case, right? Because it's not that heavy to bring a lensless body along with you. Are you doing that? I mean, are you traveling with a giant second medium format camera? Or if that one dies, you're shooting on your phone? Like, how does that go?
Most of the time, I'll try and bring someone for BTS, whether that's my wife, bless her, or I pay someone, you know, to come over. So yeah, if my camera dies, I'll just you know, steal that from them, basically. but yeah, I'm working on a better backup. But you're absolutely right, and you know, I'd never recommend someone just going with one body if they can afford two of the same bodies or two bodies that will work with each other. Then yeah, that's definitely a very good recommendation.
Yeah, and that sets you apart though, right? Because not every photographer is going to be out there with, you know, first of all, travel photographers generally are shooting full frame or micro four thirds even, right? And being the medium format photographer instantly sets you apart, which means all the overhead that goes along with that medium format camera, i.e. backups and the expense and safety and all that stuff. So it's an instant separator from from everyone else. Do you feel
one.
Like it, totally. Yeah. I can't imagine. Do you feel like you're like, or here's a better way to position this question, mobile photography or using our phones and all the computational wizardry that's packed into the phones these days, how does that work its way into your adventures? Are you shooting video or stills or anything that way? Or is it, hey, I'm strict, you know, when I shoot this kind of photography, it's with that camera or nothing?
I can't think of an example where I've used my phone as a substitute, but that being said, I haven't been in a situation where I've had to. You know, I've always had a backup of some sort. So yeah, look, I am a snob in many ways. I think of coffee and just standards and stuff. But with this, you know, I'm just about to release a course actually that the whole tagline is you can get world-class images with equipment less than $500. You know, you don't need, the camera is not the thing you need to worry about. So look, I'm confident in my ability to use anything. An iPhone, yeah, look, you know, the sensor's so small, you can get some cool shots. Like you can do photography with an iPhone, absolutely. But when I want to, like, I would just give up. I would think about something else if that was the case on a project. So like, okay, look, I'm not going to continue this with an iPhone because it's going to look completely different to anything else I've shot. So, you know, I have a style, I have a way I want to shoot that. So, you know, it's, I'm not diminishing that at all. There's a place for everything. I think as long as you know how to use it, you know, the fundamentals of photography, you know, kind of what you want to do with that rather than just hit and hope kind of thing, then I'm all for it. But I use iPhones for selfies and BTS videos, and it's such a great tool. And I can't remember what we did without it, really.
Yeah, right? It's weird. Yeah, what were we doing before phones? Not taking a lot of images, that's for sure.
Playing, you know, Tetris and snakes.
Snake, yeah, on the Nokia. You know, I want to round out. I have actually two main questions I want to throw at you. The first one is technology, right? I'm getting the vibe that you're very much a traditional photographer, you know, intentionally so. Like, you're very, very intentional about the images that you're taking. You're very intentional about the body of work and adding to it and how you're adding to it. Traditional photographer. How does the new tech work into the traditional photographer that is Matt Jacobs, like including artificial intelligence and all the computational photography tools that we have, like sky replacement and masking and all that stuff? Do you care about that, or are you incorporating that into your work, or do you keep it basic? F-stop, shutter speed, ISO, and go.
Yeah, I keep it basic purely because my brain is pretty basic. I don't want to confuse myself. Like, I used to have a Sony. My first camera my first proper like camera was Sony A7R3, and I just couldn't get used to the. I was like, well, what are all these menu functions? And even now, when I know what those things do, I still look at. Someone showed me a GFX, a Fujifilm GFX. I have no interest in this menu function. And that's why I got drawn to Hasselblad's, because their menu is like five things. It's just simple photography. And I don't want to be thinking about, I want to create something special through my own hands and my own mind. And I don't want to have to rely on the technology to kind of cover that up. But that is completely personal. Look, I have so many amazing photographer friends. Like, I look at their work and go, "You are a million times better than me. How do I get there?" And they rely a lot on technology, right? Whether that's in camera or in post. Like, some people do stuff with Lightroom, Photoshop. I'm just like, I wouldn't even know where to start. It would take me weeks to kind of learn one of these functions, right? So, look, people do look at me and go, "Oh, you're a techno nerd because you know you're a pilot and you have all these gadgets." And like, yeah, but I don't know how to use them. Like, I just like looking at them and feeling them, right? So yeah, look, I think there is a beauty in keeping things extremely intentional, keeping things as simple as possible. I mean, I heard a quote from a guy called Short Stash. I don't know if you've heard of him. He's a photographer based out of New York.
No, not familiar.
And he said the other day, he was just getting frustrated with so many photographers these days who can call themselves, kind of hide behind the edit with calling themselves a good photographer. So, you know, you may get an extremely average, maybe decent, maybe not be too bad in that you can recover it well enough in post. But you may get a very average shot and make it into something really cool and really great in Lightroom or Photoshop or any other software. And look, I'm not judging that because that's an art and a skill in itself. But for me, I want to be the best photographer that I can. I want to be the best authentic photographer that I can. And so, look, I used Photoshop. I used Lightroom. I removed distractions. I spot remove. I've never replaced skies before, but I've kind of enhanced things like smoke and stuff like that. So, look, they have to be there in the scene. I'm not a huge fan of adding stuff. Mm-hmm. But, you know, the technology these days is remarkable. I'm embracing AI as much as I can. I think we have to as photographers. I think we have to also understand that there's a place for everything. If you're one of those techno guys and you love the technology and you want to, you know, utilize it and leverage it as much as possible in order to maybe not have to think about the scene that much, then cool, go for it. I don't care. I just know what I get satisfaction and what I get fulfillment from, and that is the encounter. That's the experience. That's the moment. And you know, if you've got good light, you know, that's you know, half your battle won, right?
Yeah, I love that. It did. As we wrap this up, I lied. I said I had one more. I have actually two more questions for you. This is riveting. Okay. The first one is planning, right? You mentioned, you know, you're planning, you're a planner, you have a high level of attention to detail. What does that look like when you're planning? Like, say someone says, "Hey, Matt, we want you to either go out and shoot, or you do a self-assigned project for yourself to someplace exotic, like Madagascar or something. You're going to go out there and shoot and kind of get familiar with the people that live there and wildlife and all that. You're going to go shoot that. What does it look like once you make that decision in your head to do that? Are you in the computer and some in a program laying everything out day by day, schedule this and that? And like, how, what does it look like before you actually get on the ground there and start clicking, like the planning process?
Yeah, it's a lot of Googling. It's a new document. I use Notion now for the last kind of couple of years. I've used Notion. I love it. Like it was pretty difficult to get into just learning a new kind of piece of software. There's so many that you see all the time, but yeah. So I'll just create a page in there, and just honestly, initially, it's just a fire hose of just like thought, just brainstorming stuff right before there's any structure. So I'll just be Googling places. I'll just be trying to talk to people who's been there before. But this all kind of comes down to the overriding intent. Like, what is the point of going here? What is the point of seeing these people or trying to photograph these people? What's the story essentially? It could be something so small, but as long as there is kind of like a tagline that's underlying this whole project, then you just kind of lean into that. And I just start writing documents. Eventually that would kind of morph into a mood board. I don't really like mood boards, but it's something where the people I'm with or the subjects can see like sample images or a little bit of information about me, my previous work, or the story bits about the kind of what we're trying to say, what we're trying to do. So yeah, there's a few kind of documents that get formulated in that preparation process, but a lot of it's just research.
And how do you share that mood board? The mood, like if you're sharing the mood board with either workshop attendees or a client or whomever, or people on the ground there, how do you share that? Is that also through Notion or some other method?
Yeah, Notion. If we're in a group in Notion and everyone's kind of all over the world, it would just be in there as a PDF, or usually just as a PDF. I'll just upload it in there, and then on location, or if I'm in the studio, I'll just obviously put it on screen, hand it out, and we'll just talk through it. What are you guys thinking? What do we want to say with this? What are you thinking, like setup wise? Here's the person. What are we going to do? So yeah, I'll just share it in that respect.
Yeah, love it. All right, here is the final question, I promise. It turns out that you're not just a photographer, you're also a podcaster, and you have a podcast called The Mood Podcast. Tell me about that. What's the podcast about, and are you enjoying doing it? What's the deal with The Mood Podcast?
Yeah, I absolutely love it. I'm still really refining the mission of it. Because initially it was just the art of conversation, one frame at a time. So it was artists coming together and trying to kind of compartmentalize experiences, philosophies, and opinions into a 1-2 hour conversation. And so we were kind of learning how to connect with each other and with the audience. And as I kind of move forward into getting on 50 episodes. So I'm still kind of like at the birth of it, really. Been doing it for about a year now. I'm still kind of like refining what guests really work, what type of guests don't. I mean, I'm in Bali, so I really, really love having people in the studio and doing studio podcasts, but I'd say 1 in 5 is online, which is a shame just because, hopefully one day I'm able to go meet these people or have them over here. But as you know, that having it online is just there's just that you just can't get that connection. But it started because I just wanted to meet other photographers. I wanted to actually learn from other photographers. Like, what's your experience? Everyone's got these completely different journeys, even into the same space, if you're in the same genre or same kind of sector of photography. But everyone has their story to tell, which is just so fantastic and inspiring. And selfishly, I get to learn from loads of people and hear about you know, their experiences, their lessons, their tips and tricks, their opinions on things. We talk a lot about opinions on how photography moves forward in today's age, how we express ourselves with the kind of behemoths of social media kind of hanging over our heads and all this kind of stuff. So it does get philosophized quite a lot, but you know, it's just about me having fun for myself. It's a completely selfish endeavor. I don't know how, you know, when you started this show, I don't know if you're just, you know, I just want to chat to people, right? So yeah. Now I'm having to think like, okay, well, I have to think a bit more strategically about it. I can't just, you know, I'm not going to be a Joe Rogan where it's like, you just chat for a couple of hours, you know, just without any structure, without any kind of purpose to move things forward. And like you probably heard for the last hour, I'm big on intent. So I need to kind of refine that a little bit with the podcast. Like what is the intent of this? It cannot just be any more about me having fun for my own sake, right? Me meeting people because I want to meet them. So yeah, I kind of have to balance those two worlds, but I'm loving it.
Yeah. Well, sometimes it is that though. There's a bit of that in there because the podcast is you, like it or not. So, you know, sometimes it is about, hey, I want to meet that person. I'm going to use my podcast as a vehicle or a catalyst to getting in front of that person and having the conversation, which I think, you know, you could look at that as selfish. But I look at it as, like we were saying before we started recording, I feel like the This Week in Photo audience is me. I am a member of my audience. So the questions and the desires for conversations that I want to have, I feel like lots of people want to have those conversations. Even here, like the questions that I'm asking you, I feel like I'm a conduit to from my audience asking the questions that they'd want to hear. I even sometimes think like someone's in their car driving, listening to this conversation, and they're like, yes, ask that question. That's the question I wanted to ask, right? So, you know, as long as you're doing that, and like we talked about, if you're doing an interview about something that you're not passionate about, that's where the, you know, the imposter syndrome and disingenuity and all that start creeping into the conversation. And people can smell that a mile away. If you're not interested in something and not excited about it and you're going through the motions, you know, and I found that the worst place for that to manifest is when you're on stage doing a talk and you feel like, you know, maybe the audience knows more about your topic than you do and you're up there.
I feel like that all the time, though. I feel like that all the time. Like, what am I doing here? Like, everyone listening to this knows more about photography than I do. So, you know, it's, I get it. And, you know, hopefully I'd love to. I'm super interested to hear about your story, your experiences in photography. So I'd love to return the favor one day and get you on the show.
Oh, I love to come on. Yeah. Whenever you say the word and I'll be there.
Yep.
I'm going to throw a compliment at you.
Make it happen.
Oh yeah. Yeah. Just say the word. Send me a note. I'm looking at your website right now. I love your website. I love the simplicity and, like you said, the intent of your website. I know exactly what you want me to know about Matt Jacobs when I look at your website, and it's all in one nice little spot. So kudos on not only the body of work, of course, but also the presentation and all that. It's very, very nice. So check it out, folks. Matt Jacobs. You have it as Matt Jacob Photography, right? Is that the...
Yeah, so, yeah, Jacob without the S. Yep. So
without the S.
Two first names, basically. Yeah.
There you go. All right. We'll leave it right there. Thank you so much, Matt. I appreciate you coming on. This has been fantastic. And definitely you will be coming on. You'll be coming on again. I'll put all the links to the various places where you have presences online. I'll put that in the show notes, especially the body of work. I encourage people to definitely go check out the body of work and kind of watch it. Look at the body of work while you're listening to this episode to kind of make it click, because it's really interesting once you kind of understand that this is all shot with probably one lens, a 50 millimeter equivalent on full frame and not full frame. Yeah. But in medium format as well. And look at the quality of the images and see if you can note the quality difference between a full frame body and a medium format body. So very, very nice. We're, you know, other than MacJacobPhotography.com, where would you like people to go to connect with you and find out more? Or is that the center of the universe there?
No, unfortunately, Instagram's the center of the universe, I think, with many photographers. So yeah, you can check me out there at Matty J. But if you, you know, if you're on the website, all my socials are on there. So yeah, head to the website. You can kind of see my portfolio on there and my social links to check me out on IG and come join me. I've got a broadcast list on IG so we can have a bit of a community chat. And yeah, hope to see everyone there.
All right, sir. Thank you so much for coming on. I appreciate you. And get some coffee in you. It's the beginning of your day now, right? You mentioned you're a coffee snob, and I know as soon as you said coffee, your brain went into coffee mode, right?
We have a cafe downstairs, so you know, I'm sat in my studio now, so I'm gonna like rush down the stairs and make a coffee. So thanks so much for having me on. It's been an absolute pleasure, and I look forward to speaking with you hopefully on my show one day.
Yeah, likewise. All right, sir, enjoy that coffee, enjoy your weekend, and thanks for getting up early for us. We appreciate that.
No, not at all. Thank you. Cheers.
This is Twitter.